and had his men edging upward again. His four and Griggs moved almost side by side, with Eric's 50 feet below. Deerhorn axes chopped and hacked, sending showers of glittery shards cascading down onto the trees. Stone hammers pounded stakes deep into the ice to serve as anchors for the ropes. The iron stakes ran out before they were halfway up, and after that the climbers used horn and sharpened bone. And the men kicked, driving the spikes on their boots against the hard, unyielding ice again and again and again and again to make one foothold. Their legs must be numb, John thought, by the fourth hour. How long can they keep on with that? He watched as restless as the Magna, listening for the distant moan of a thin war horn. But the horn stayed silent, and there was no sign of the night's watch. By the sixth hour, Jarl had moved ahead of Grig the goat again, and his men were widening the gap.
"The manse's pet must want a sword," the Magna said, shading his eyes.
The sun was high in the sky, and the upper third of the wall was a crystalline blue from below, reflecting so brilliantly that it hurt the eyes to look on it. Jarl's four and Griggs were all but lost in the glare, though Eric's team was still in shadow. Instead of moving upward, they were edging their way sideways at about 500 feet, making for a chimney. John was watching them inch along when he heard the sound, a sudden crack that seemed to roll along the ice, followed by a shout of alarm, and then the air was full of shards and shrieks and falling men, as a sheet of ice, a foot thick and 50 feet square, broke off from the wall and came tumbling, crumbling, rumbling, sweeping all before it. Even down at the foot of the ridge some chunks came spinning through the trees and rolling down the slope. John grabbed Ygritte and pulled her down to shield her, and one of the Thens was struck in the face by a chunk that broke his nose. And when they looked up, Jarl and his team were gone. Men, rope, stakes, all gone. Nothing remained above 600 feet. There was a wound in the wall where the climbers had clung half a heartbeat before. The ice within as smooth and white as polished marble and shining in the sun. Far, far below, there was a faint red smear where someone had smashed against a frozen pinnace. The wall defends itself, John thought, as he pulled Ygritte back to her feet. They found Jarl in a tree, impaled upon a splintered branch, and still roped to the three men who lay broken beneath him. One was still alive, but his legs and spine were shattered, and most of his ribs as well.
"Mercy!"
he said when they came upon him. One of the Thens smashed his head in with a big stone mace. The Magna gave orders, and his men began to gather fuel for a pyre. The dead were burning when Grig the Goat reached the top of the wall. By the time Eric's four had joined them, nothing remained of Jarl and his team but bone and ash. The sun had begun to sink by then, so the climbers wasted little time. They unwound the long coils of hemp they had looped around their chests, tied them all together, and tossed down one end. The thought of trying to climb 500 feet up that rope filled John with dread, but Mance had planned better than that. The raiders Jarl had left below uncast a huge ladder, with rungs of woven hemp as thick as a man's arm, and tied it to the climber's rope. Eric and Grig and their men grunted and heaved, pulled it up, staked it to the top, then lowered the rope again and hauled up a second ladder. There were five altogether. When all of them were in place, the Magnor shouted a brusque command in the old tongue, and five of his Thens started up together. Even with the ladders it was no easy climb. Ygritte watched them struggle for a while. "I hate this wall," she said in a low, angry voice. "Can you feel how cold it is?" "It's made of ice," John pointed out.
"You know nothing, Jon Snow. This wall is made of blood."
Nor had it drunk its fill. By sunset, two of the Thens had fallen from the ladder to their deaths, but they were the last. It was near midnight before John reached the top. The stars were out again, and Ygritte was trembling from the climb.
"I almost fell," she said with tears in her eyes. "Twice, thrice.
The wall was trying to shake me off. I could feel it.
One of the tears broke free and trickled down her cheek. The worst is behind us. John tried to sound confident. Don't be frightened. He tried to put an arm around her. Ygritte slammed the heel of her hand into his chest, so hard it stung even through his layers of wool, mail, and boiled leather.
I wasn't frightened. You know nothing, Jon Snow.
Why are you crying, then?
Not for fear.
She kicked savagely at the ice beneath her with a heel, chopping out a chunk.
I'm crying because we never found the Horn of Winter. We opened 50 graves and let all those shades loose in the world, and never found the Horn of Joriman to bring this cold thing down.
Jamie. His hand burned. Still long after they had snuffed out the torch they'd used to sear his bloody stump. Days after, he could still feel the fire lancing up his arm, and his fingers twisting in the flames, the fingers he no longer had. He had taken wounds before, but never like this. He had never known there could be such pain. Sometimes, unbidden, old prayers bubbled from his lips, prayers he learned as a child and never thought of since, prayers he had first prayed with Cersei kneeling beside him in the sept at Castle Rock. Sometimes he even wept until he heard the mummers laughing. Then he made his eyes go dry and his heart go dead, and prayed for his fever to burn away his tears. Now I know how Tyrion has felt all those times they laughed at him. After the second time he fell from the saddle, they bound him tight to Brienne of Tarth, and made them share a horse again. One day, instead of back to front, they bound them face to face.
"Ah, the lovers!" Shagwell sighed loudly. "Ah, what a lovely sight they are! 'Twould be cruel to separate the good knight and his lady." Then he laughed, that shrill high laugh of his, and said, "Arr, but which one is the knight, and which one is the lady?"
"If I had my hand, you'd learn that soon enough," Jamie thought. His arms ached, and his legs were numb from the ropes, but after a while none of that mattered. His will shrunk to the throb of agony that was his phantom hand, and Brienne pressed against him. "She's warm, at least," he consoled himself, though the wench's breath was as foul as his own. His hand was always between them. Erswick had hung it about his neck on a cord, so it dangled down against his chest, slapping Brienne's breasts as Jamie slipped in and out of consciousness. His right eye was swollen shut, the wound inflamed where Brienne had cut him during their fight, but it was his hand that hurt the most. Blood and pus seeped from the stump, and the missing hand throbbed every time the horse took a step. His throat was so raw he could not eat, but he drank wine when they gave it him, and water when that was all they offered. Once they handed him a cup, and he quaffed it straight away, trembling, and the brave companions burst into laughter so loud and harsh it hurt his ears.
"That's horse piss you're drinking, Kingslayer,"
Rorg told him. Jamie was so thirsty he drank it anyway, but afterward he retched it all back up. They made Brienne wash the vomit out of his beard, just as they had made her clean him up when he soiled himself in the saddle. One damp cold morning, when he was feeling slightly stronger, a madness took hold of him, and he reached for the Dornishman's sword with his left hand and wrenched it clumsily from its scabbard. "Let them kill me," he thought, "so long as I die fighting, a blade in hand." But it was no good. Shagwell came hopping from leg to leg, dancing nimbly aside when Jamie slashed at him. Unbalanced, he staggered forward, hacking wildly at the fool, but Shagwell spun and ducked and darted until all the mummers were laughing at Jamie's futile efforts to land a blow. When he tripped over a rock and stumbled to his knees, the fool leapt in and planted a wet kiss atop his head. Rorg finally flung him aside and kicked the sword from Jamie's feeble fingers as he tried to bring it up.
"That was amusing, Kingslayer," said Vargo Hote. "But if you try it again, I should take your other hand, or perhaps a foot."
Jamie lay on his back afterwards, staring at the night sky, trying not to feel the pain that snaked up his right arm every time he moved it. The night was strangely beautiful. The moon was a graceful crescent, and it seemed as though he had never seen so many stars. The king's crown was at the zenith, and he could see the stallion rearing, and there the swan. The moon maid, shy as ever, was half hidden behind a pine tree. "How can such a night be beautiful?" he asked himself. "Why would the stars want to look down on such as me?"
"Jamie," Brian whispered, so faintly he thought he was dreaming it. "Jamie, what are you doing?"
"Dying," he whispered back.
"No," she said, "no, you must live."
He wanted to laugh. "Stop telling me what to do, wench. I'll die if it pleases me."
"Are you so craven?"
The word shocked him. He was Jamie Lannister, a knight of the King's Guard. He was the Kingslayer. No man had ever called him craven. Other things they called him. Yes, oathbreaker, liar, murderer. They said he was cruel, treacherous, reckless, but never craven. "What else can I do but die?"
"Live," she said. "Live and fight and take revenge."
But she spoke too loudly. Rorg heard her voice, if not her words, and came over to kick her, shouting at her to hold her bloody tongue if she wanted to keep it.
"Craven," Jamie thought, as Brian fought to stifle her moans.
"Can it be? They took my sword hand. Was that all I was, a sword hand? Gods be good, is it true?"
The wench had the right of it. He could not die. Cersei was waiting for him. She would have need of him. And Tyrion, his little brother, who loved him for a lie. And his enemies were waiting too, the young wolf who had beaten him in the Whispering Wood and killed his men around him. Edmure Tully, who had kept him in darkness and chains, these brave companions. When morning came, he made himself eat. They fed him a mush of oats, horse food, but he forced down every spoon. He ate again at evenfall and the next day.
"Live," he told himself harshly, when the mush was like to gag him. "Live for Cersei, live for Tyrion, live for vengeance. A Lannister always pays his debts."
His missing hand throbbed and burned and stank.
"When I reach King's Landing, I'll have a new hand forged, a golden hand, and one day I'll use it to rip out Vargo Hoat's throat."
The days and the nights blurred together in a haze of pain. He would sleep in the saddle, pressed against Brienne, his nose full of the stink of his rotting hand, and then at night he would lie awake on the hard ground, caught in a waking nightmare. Weak as he was, they always bound him to a tree. It gave him some cold consolation to know that they feared him that much, even now. Brienne was always bound beside him. She lay there in her bonds like a big dead cow, saying not a word.
"The wench has built a fortress inside herself. They will rape her soon enough, but behind her walls they cannot touch her."
But Jamie's walls were gone. They had taken his hand. They had taken his sword hand, and without it he was nothing. The other was no good to him. Since the time he could walk, his left arm had been his shield arm no more. It was his right hand that made him a knight, his right arm that made him a man. One day he heard Erswick say something about Harrenhal and remembered that was to be their destination. That made him laugh aloud, and that made Timian slash his face with a long, thin whip. The cut bled, but beside his hand he scarcely felt it.
"Why did you laugh?" the wench asked him that night in a whisper. "Harrenhal was where they gave me the white cloak," he whispered back. "Whence great Tawny. He wanted to show us all his big castle and his fine sons. I wanted to show them too. I was only 15, but no one could have beat me that day. Ares never let me joust." He laughed again. "He sent me away. But now I'm coming back."
They heard the laugh. That night it was Jamie who got the kicks and punches. He hardly felt them either, until Rorg slammed a boot into his stump, and then he fainted. It was the next night when they finally came. Three of the worst. Shagwell, Noseless Rorg, and Fat Dothraki Zolo, the one who'd cut his hand off. Zolo and Rorg were arguing about who would go first as they approached. There seemed to be no question but that the fool would be going last. Shagwell suggested they should both go first and take her front and rear. Zolo and Rorg liked that notion, only then they began to fight about who would get the front and who the rear. They will leave her a cripple too, but inside, where it does not show. "Wench," he whispered, as Zolo and Rorg were cursing one another, "let them have the meat, and you go far away. It will be over quicker, and they will get less pleasure from it."
"They will get no pleasure from what I'll give them," she whispered back, defiant.
Stupid, stubborn, brave bitch. She was going to get herself good and killed, he knew it. And what do I care if she does? If she hadn't been so pig-headed, I still have a hand. Yet he heard himself whisper, "Let them do it, and go away inside." That was what he'd done when the Starks had died before him, Lord Rickard cooking in his armor while his son Brandon strangled himself trying to save him. Think of Renly, if you loved him. Think of Tarth, mountains and seas, pools, waterfalls, whatever you have on your Sapphire Isle, think. But Rorg had won the argument by then.
"You're the ugliest woman I ever seen," he told Brian. "But don't think I can't make you uglier. You want a nose like mine? Find me, and you'll get one. And two eyes, that's too many. One scream out of you, and I'll pop one out and make you eat it. And then I'll pull your fucking teeth out, one by one."
"Oh, do it, Rorg," pleaded Shagwell. "Without her teeth, she'll look just like my dear old mother." He cackled. "And I always wanted to fuck my dear old mother up the ass."
Jamie chuckled. "There's a funny fool. I have a riddle for you, Shagwell. Why do you care if she screams?"
"Oh, wait! I know!"
he shouted. "Sapphires!" as loudly as he could. Cursing, Rorg kicked at his stump again. Jamie howled. "I never knew there was such agony in the world," was the last thing he remembered thinking. It was hard to say how long he was gone, but when the pain spit him out, Urswick was there, and Vargo Hote himself.
"'Feet not to be touched!" the goat screamed, spraying spittle all over Zola. "'Feet hath to be a maid, you fools! Feet's worth a bagful of sapphires!"
And from then on, every night, Hote put guards on them to protect them from his own. Two nights passed in silence before the wench found the courage to whisper.
"Jamie, why did you shout out?" "Why did I shout sapphires, you mean? Use your wits, wench. Would this lot have cared if I'd shouted rape?" "You did not need to shout at all. You're hard enough to look at with a nose. Besides, I wanted to make the ghost say Fafarth," he chuckled. "A good thing for you, I'm such a liar. An honourable man would have told the truth about the Sapphire Isle." "All the same," she said, "I thank you, sir."
His hand was throbbing again. He ground his teeth and said, "A Lannister pays his debts. That was for the river and those rocks you dropped on Robin Rhaegar." The goat wanted to make a show of parading him in, so Jamie was made to dismount a mile from the gates in Harrenhal. A rope was looped around his waist, a second around Brian's wrists. The ends were tied to the pommel of Vargo Hote's saddle. They stumbled along side by side, behind the Kohorik's striped zorse. Jamie's rage kept him walking. The linen that covered the stump was grey and stinking with pus. His phantom fingers screamed with every step. "I am stronger than they know," he told himself. "I am still a Lannister. I am still a knight of the King's Guard." He would reach Harrenhal, and then King's Landing. He would live, and I will pay this debt with interest. As they approached the cliff-like walls of Black Harren's monstrous castle, Brian squeezed his arm.
Lord Bolton holds his castle. The Boltons are bannermen to the Starks.
The Boltons skin their enemies. Jamie remembered that much about the Northmen. Tyrion would have known all there was to know about the Lord of the Dreadfort, but Tyrion was 1,000 leagues away with Cersei.
I cannot die while Cersei lives, he told himself. We will die together, as we were born together.
The Castleton outside the walls had been burned to ash and blackened stone, and many men and horses had recently encamped beside the lake shore, where Lord Went had staged his great tourney in the year of the false spring. A bitter smile touched Jamie's lips as they crossed that torn ground. Someone had dug a privy trench in the very spot where he'd once knelt before the king to say his vows.
I never dreamed how quick the sweet would turn to sour. Ares would not even let me savour that one night. He honoured me, and then he spat on me. The banners, Brian observed. Flayed man and Twin Tire, see? King Rob's sworn men, there, above the gatehouse, grey and white. They fly the direwolf.
Jamie twisted his head upward for a look. That's your bloody wolf, true enough, he grunted her, and those are heads to either side of it. Soldiers, servants, and camp followers gathered to hoot at them. A spotted bitch followed them through the camps, barking and growling, until one of the Lyseni impaled her on a lance and galloped to the front of the column.
I am bearing Kingslayer's banner, he shouted, shaking the dead dog above Jaime's head.
The walls of Harrenhal were so thick that passing beneath them was like passing through a stone tunnel. Vargo Hote had sent two of his Dothraki ahead to inform Lord Bolton of their coming, so the outer ward was full of the curious. They gave way as Jamie staggered past, the rope around his waist, jerking and pulling at him whenever he slowed.
"I'll give you the Kingslayer,"
Vargo Hote proclaimed in that thick, slubbery voice of his. A spear jabbed at the small of Jamie's back, sending him sprawling. Instinct made him put out his hands to stop his fall. When his stump smashed against the ground, the pain was blinding. Yet somehow he managed to fight his way back to one knee. Before him, a flight of broad stone steps led up to the entrance of one of Harrenhal's colossal round towers. Five knights and a Northman stood looking down on him, the one pale-eyed in wool and fur, the five fierce in mail and plate, with a Twin Tower sigil on their surcoats.
"A fury of Freys," Jamie declared. "Sir Danwell? Sir Aenys, Sir Hastine."
He knew Lord Walder's sons by sight. His aunt had married one, after all.
"You have my condolences."
"For what, sir?" Sir Danwell Frey asked.
"Your brother's son, Sir Cleos," said Jamie. "He was with us until outlaws filled him full of arrows. Urswick and this lot took his goods and left him for the wolves."
"My lords," Brian wrenched herself free and pushed forward. "I saw your banners. Hear me for your oath."
"Who speaks?" demanded Sir Aenys Frey.
"Lannister's wet nurse.
I am Brian of Tarth, daughter to Lord Selwyn, the Evenstar, and sworn to House Stark even as you are."
Sir Aenys spit at her feet.
"That's for your oath. We trusted the word of Robb Stark, and he repaid our faith with betrayal."
Now this is interesting. Jamie twisted to see how Brian might take the accusation, but the wench was as single-minded as a mule with a bit between his teeth.
"I know of no betrayal."
She chafed at the ropes around her wrists.
"Lady Catelyn commanded me to deliver Lannister to his brother at King's Landing."
"She was trying to drown him when we found them," said Urswick the Faithful.
She reddened.
"In anger I forgot myself, but I would never have killed him. If he dies, the Lannisters will put my lady's daughters to the sword."
Sir Aenys was unmoved.
"Why should that trouble us?" "Ransom him back to Riverrun," urged Sir Danwell. "Castle Rock has more gold," one brother objected.
"Kill him," said another.
his head for Ned Stark's.
Shagwell the Fool somersaulted to the foot of the steps in his grey and pink motley and began to sing.
There once was a lion who danced with a bear. Oh my, oh my!
Silence, fool!
Varga Hote cuffs the man.
The Kingslayer is not for the bear. He is mine.
He is no one, should he die.
Roose Bolton spoke so softly that men quieted to hear him.
And pray recall, my lord, you are not master of Harrenhal till I march north.
Fever made Jamie as fearless as he was light-headed.
Can this be the lord of the Dreadfort?
When last I heard, my father had sent you scampering off with your tail betwixt your legs.
When did you stop running, my lord?
Bolton's silence was 100 times more threatening than Varga Hote's slubbering malevolence. Pale as morning mist, his eyes concealed more than they told. Jamie misliked those eyes. They reminded him of the day at King's Landing when Ned Stark had found him seated on the Iron Throne. The Lord of the Dreadfort finally pursed his lips and said,
"You have lost a hand."
"No," said Jamie, "I have it here, hanging round my neck."
Roose Bolton reached down, snapped the cord, and flung the hand at Hote.
"Take this away. The sight of it offends me."
"I will send it to his Lord Father. I will tell him he must pay 100,000 dragons, or we shall return the Kingslayer to him, piece by piece, and when we have his gold, we shall deliver Sir Jamie to Carstark, and collect a maiden too."
A roar of laughter went up from the brave companions.
"A fine plan," said Roose Bolton, the same way he might say a fine wine to a dinner companion. "Though Lord Carstark may not be giving you his daughter, King Rob has shortened him by head for treason and murder. As to Lord Tywin, he remains at King's Landing, and there he will stay until the new year, when his grandson takes for bride a daughter of Highgarden."
"Winterfell?" said Brian, "you mean Winterfell. King Joffrey is betrothed to Sansa Stark."
"No longer. The Battle of the Blackwater changed all. The Rose and the Lion joined there to shatter Stannis Baratheon's host and burn his fleet to ashes."
"I warned you, Erzmik," Jamie thought, "and you, Goat. When you bet against the Lions, you lose more than your purse."
"Is there word of my sister?" he asked.
"She is well, as is your, nephew."
Bolton paused before he said nephew, a pause that said, "I know."
"Your brother also lives, though he took a wound in the battle."
He beckoned to a dour Northman in a studded brigantine.
"Escort Sir Jamie to Kyburn, and unbind this woman's hands."
As the rope between Brian's wrists was slashed in two, he said,
"Pray forgive us, my lady. In such troubled times, it is hard to know friend from foe."
Brian rubbed inside her wrist, where the hemp had scraped her skin bloody.
"My lord, these men tried to rape me."
"Did they?"
Lord Bolton turned his pale eyes on Varga Hote.
"I am displeased by that and this of Sir Jamie's hand."
There were 5 Northmen and as many Freys in the yard for every brave companion. The Goat might not be as clever as some, but he could count that high at least. He held his tongue.
"They took my sword," Brian said, "my armor." "You shall have no need of armor here, my lady,"
Lord Bolton told her.
"In Harrenhal you are under my protection. Amabel, find suitable rooms for the Lady Brian. Alton, you will see to Sir Jamie at once."
He did not wait for an answer, but turned and climbed the steps, his fur-trimmed cloak swirling behind. Jamie had only enough time to exchange a quick look with Brian before they were marched away separately. In the maester's chambers beneath the rookery, a grey-haired, fatherly man named Kyburn sucked in his breath when he cut away the linen from the stump of Jamie's hand.
"That bad? Will I die?"
Kyburn pushed at the wound with a finger, and wrinkled his nose at the gush of pus.
No, though in a few more days.
He sliced away Jamie's sleeve.
The corruption has spread. See how tender the flesh is. I must cut it all away. The safest course would be to take the arm off.
Then you'll die, Jamie promised. Clean the stump and sew it up. I'll take my chances. Qyburn frowned.
I can leave you the upper arm, make the cut at your elbow, but...
Take any part of my arm, and you'd best chop off the other one as well, or I'll strangle you with it afterward.
Qyburn looked in his eyes. Whatever he saw there gave him pause.
Very well. I will cut away the rotten flesh, no more. Try to burn out the corruption with boiling wine and a poultice of nettle, mustard seed, and bread mould. Mayhaps that will suffice. It is on your head. You will want milk of the poppy.
No. Jamie dare not let himself be put to sleep. He might be short an arm when he woke, no matter what the man said. Qyburn was taken aback.
There will be pain.
I'll scream.
A great deal of pain.
I'll scream very loudly.
Will you take some wine, at least?
Does the High Septon ever pray?
Of that I'm not certain. I shall bring the wine. Lie back, I must needs strap down your arm.
With a bowl and a sharp blade, Qyburn cleaned the stump, while Jamie gulped down strong wine, spilling it all over himself in the process. His left hand did not seem to know how to find his mouth, but there was something to be said for that. The smell of wine in his sodden beard helped disguise the stench of pus. Nothing helped when the time came to pare away the rotten flesh. Jamie did scream then, and pounded the table with his good fist over and over and over again. He screamed again when Qyburn poured boiling wine over what remained of his stump. Despite all his vows and all his fears, he lost consciousness for a time. When he woke, the maester was sewing at his arm with needle and catgut.
I left a flapper skin to fold back over your wrist.
You have done this before, muttered Jamie weakly. He could taste blood in his mouth where he'd bitten his tongue.
No man who serves with Vargo Hope is a stranger to stumps. He makes them wherever he goes.
Qyburn do not look a monster, Jamie thought. He was spare and soft-spoken, with warm brown eyes. How does a maester come to ride with the brave companions?
The citadel took my chain.
Qyburn put away his needle.
I should do something about that wound above your eye as well. The flesh is badly inflamed.
Jamie closed his eyes and let the wine and Qyburn do their work.
Tell me of the battle. As keeper of Harrenhal's ravens, Qyburn would have been the first to hear the news.
Lord Stannis was caught between your father and the fire. It said the imp set the river itself aflame.
Jamie saw green flames reaching up into the sky, higher than the tallest towers, as burning men screamed in the streets.
I have dreamed this dream before.
It was almost funny, but there was no one to share the joke.
Open your eye.
Qyburn soaked a cloth in warm water and dabbed at the crust of dried blood. The eyelid was swollen, but Jamie found he could force it open halfway. Qyburn's face loomed above.
How did you come by this one?
The maester asked. A wench's gift.
Rough wooing, my lord.
This wench is bigger than me and uglier than you. You'd best see to her as well. She's still limping on the leg I pricked when we fought.
I will ask after her. What is this woman to you?
My protector.
Jamie had to laugh, no matter how it hurt.
I'll grind some herbs you can mix with wine to bring down your fever. Come back on the morrow, and I'll put a leech on your eye to drain the bad blood.
A leech? Lovely.
Lord Bolton is very fond of leeches,
Qyburn said primly.
Yes, said Jamie. He would be.
Tyrion. Nothing remained beyond the King's Gate but mud and ashes and bits of burned bone. Yet already there were people living in the shadow of the city walls, and others selling fish from barrows and barrels. Tyrion felt their eyes on him as he rode past, chilly eyes, angry and unsympathetic. No one dared speak to him, or try to bar his way, not with Brunn beside him in oiled black mail.
If I were alone, though, they would pull me down and smash my face in with a cobblestone, as they did for Preston Greenfield.
They come back quicker than the rats, he complained. We burn them out once. You think they'd take that as a lesson?
Give me a few dozen gold cloaks, and I'll kill them all, said Brunn. Once they're dead, they don't come back.
No, but others come in their places. Leave them be. But if they start throwing up hovels against the wall again, pull them down at once. The war's not done yet, no matter what these fools may think. He spied the mud gate up ahead. I have seen enough for now. We'll return on the morrow with the guild masters to go over their plans, he sighed. Well, I burned most of this. I suppose it's only just that I rebuild it. That task was to have been his uncle's. But solid, steady, tireless Sir Kevin Lannister had not been himself since the Raven had come from Riverrun with word of his son's murder. Willem's twin, Martin, had been taken captive by Robb Stark as well, and their elder brother, Lancel, was still abed, beset by an ulcerating wound that would not heal. With one son dead, and two more in mortal danger, Sir Kevin was consumed by grief and fear. Lord Tywin had always relied on his brother, but now he had no choice but to turn again to his dwarf son. The cost of rebuilding was going to be ruinous, but there was no help for that. King's Landing was the realm's principal harbour, rivaled only by Old Town. The river had to be reopened, and the sooner the better. And where am I going to find the bloody coin? It was almost enough to make him miss Littlefinger, who had sailed north a fortnight past. While he beds Lysa Arran and rules the Vale beside her, I got to clean up the mess he left behind him. Though at least his father was giving him significant work to do.
He won't name me heir to Casterly Rock, but he'll make use of me wherever he can, Tyrion thought, as a captain of gold cloaks waved them through the mud gate.
The three whores still dominated the market square inside the gate, but they stood idle now, and the boulders and barrels of pitch had all been trundled away. There were children climbing the towering wooden structures, swarming up like monkeys in rough spun, to perch on the throwing arms and hoot at each other.
"Remind me to tell Sir Adam to put some gold cloaks here," Tyrion told Brunn as they rode between two of the trebuchets. "Some fool boy is likely to fall off and break his back."
There was a shout from above, and a clod of manure exploded on the ground a foot in front of them. Tyrion's mare reared and almost threw him.
"On second thoughts," he said, when he had the horse in hand, "let the poxy brats spatter on the cobbles like overripe melons."
He was in a black mood, and not just because a few street urchins wanted to pelt him with dung. His marriage was a daily agony. Sansa Stark remained a maiden, and half the castle seemed to know it. When they had saddled up this morning, he heard two of the stable boys sniggering behind his back. He could almost imagine that the horses were sniggering as well. He'd risked his skin to avoid the bedding ritual, hoping to preserve the privacy of his bedchamber, but that hope had been dashed quick enough. Either Sansa had been stupid enough to confide in one of her bedmaids, every one of whom was a spy for Cersei, or Varys and his little birds were to blame. What difference did it make? They were laughing at him all the same. The only person in the Red Keep who didn't seem to find his marriage a source of amusement was his lady wife. Sansa's misery was deepening every day. Tyrion would gladly have broken through her courtesy to give her what solace he might, but it was no good. No words would ever make him fair in her eyes.
Or any less a Lannister.
This was the wife they had given him, for all the rest of his life, and she hated him. And their nights together in the great bed were another source of torment. He could no longer bear to sleep naked, as had been his custom. His wife was too well trained ever to say an unkind word, but the revulsion in her eyes, whenever she looked on his body, was more than he could bear. Tyrion had commanded Sansa to wear a sleeping shift as well.
"I want her," he realized. "I want Winterfell, yes, but I want her as well, child or woman or whatever she is. I want to comfort her. I want to hear her laugh. I want her to come to me willingly, to bring me her joys and her sorrows and her lust."
His mouth twisted in a bitter smile.
"Yes, and I want to be tall as Jamie and as strong as Sir Gregor the Mountain, too, for all the bloody good it does."
Unbidden, his thoughts went to Shay. Tyrion had not wanted her to hear the news from any lips but his own, so he had commanded Varys to bring her to him the night before his wedding. They met again in the eunuch's chambers, and when Shay began to undo the laces of his jerkin, he caught her by the wrist and pushed it away.
"Wait," he said, "there is something you must hear. On the morrow I am to be wed to Sansa Stark, or no?"
He was speechless for an instant. Even Sansa did not know, not then.
"How could you know? Did Varys tell you?" "Some page was telling Sir Tallard about it when I took Lollies to the Sept. He had it from this serving girl who'd heard Sir Kevin talking to your father."
She wriggled free of his grasp and pulled her dress up over her head. As ever, she was naked underneath.
"I don't care. She's only a little girl. You'll give her a big belly and come back to me."
Some part of him had hoped for less indifference.
"Had hoped," he jeered bitterly. "But now you know better, dwarf. Shay is all the love you're ever like to have."
Muddy Way was crowded, but soldiers and townfolk alike made way for the imp and his escort. Hollow-eyed children swarmed underfoot, some looking up in silent appeal while others begged noisily. Tyrion pulled a big fistful of coppers from his purse and tossed them in the air, and the children went running for them, shoving and shouting. The lucky ones might be able to buy a heel of stale bread tonight. He had never seen markets so crowded, and for all the food the Tyrells were bringing in, prices remained shockingly high. 6 coppers for a melon, a silver stag for a bushel of corn, a dragon for a side of beef, or 6 skinny piglets. Yet there seemed no lack of buyers. Gaunt men and haggard women crowded around every wagon and stall, whilst others even more ragged looked on sullenly from the mouths of alleys.
"This way," Bronn said, as they reached the foot of the hook. "If you still mean to—"
"I do."
The riverfront had made a convenient excuse, but Tyrion had another purpose today. It was not a task he relished, but it must be done. They turned away from Aegon's high hill into the maze of smaller streets that clustered around the foot of Visenya's. Bronn led the way. Once or twice, Tyrion glanced back over his shoulder to see if they were being followed, but there was nothing to be seen except the usual rabble. A carter beating his horse, an old woman throwing night soil from her window, 2 little boys fighting with sticks, 3 gold cloaks escorting a captive. They all looked innocent, but any one of them could be his undoing. Varys had informers everywhere. They turned at a corner, and again at the next, and rode slowly through a crowd of women at a well. Bronn led him along a curving wind through an alley under a broken archway. They cut through the rubble where a house had burned and walked their horses up a shallow flight of stone steps. The buildings were close and poor. Bronn halted at the mouth of a crooked alley too narrow for 2 to ride abreast.
"There's 2 jags and then a dead end. The sink is in the cellar of the last building."
Tyrion swung down off his horse. "See that no one enters or leaves till I return. This won't take long." His hand went into his cloak to make certain the gold was still there in the hidden pocket. 30 dragons. A bloody fortune for a man like him. He waddled up the alley quickly, anxious to be done with this. The wine sink was a dismal place, dark and damp, walls pale with nitre, the ceiling so low that Bronn would have to duck to keep from hitting his head on the beams. Tyrion Lannister had no such problem. At this hour the front room was empty, but for a dead-eyed woman who sat on a stool behind a rough plank bar. She handed him a cup of sour wine and said, "In the back." The back room was even darker. A flickering candle burned on a low table beside a flagon of wine. The man behind it scarce looked in danger, a short man, though all men were tall to Tyrion, with thinning brown hair, pink cheeks, and a little pot pushing at the bone buttons of his doeskin jerkin. In his soft hands he held a 12-stringed woodharp, more deadly than a longsword. Tyrion sat across from him. "Simon Silvertongue?" The man inclined his head. He was bald on top.
"My lord and," he said, "you mistake me. My father is the king's hand. I am no longer even a finger, I fear." "You shall rise again, I am sure, a man like you. My sweet lady Shade tells me you are newly wed. Would that you had sent for me earlier. I should have been honoured to sing at your feast."
"The last thing my wife needs is more songs," said Tyrion. "As for Shay, we both know she is no lady, and I would thank you never to speak her name aloud."
"As the hand commands," Simon said.
The last time Tyrion had seen the man, a sharp word had been enough to set him sweating, but it seemed the singer had found some courage somewhere, most like in that flagon. Or perhaps Tyrion himself was to blame for this new boldness.
"I threatened him, but nothing ever came of the threat, so now he believes me toothless."
He sighed. "I am told you are a very gifted singer."
"You're most kind to say so, my lord."
Tyrion gave him a smile.
"I think it is time you brought your music to the free cities. They are great lovers of song in Braavos and Pentos and Lys, and generous with those who please them."
He took a sip of wine. It was foul stuff, but strong.
"A tour of all 9 cities would be best. You wouldn't want to deny anyone the joy of hearing you sing. A year in each would suffice."
He reached inside his cloak to where the gold was hidden.
"With the port closed, you will need to go to Duskendale to take ship. But my man Bronn will find a horse for you, and I would be honoured if you would let me pay your passage."
"But, my lord," the man objected, "you've never heard me sing. Pray, listen a moment."
His fingers moved deftly over the strings of the woodharp, and soft music filled the cellar. Simon began to sing.
"He rode through the streets of the city, down from his hill on high. O'er the wines and the steps and the cobbles, he rode to a woman's sigh. For she was his secret treasure, she was his shame and his bliss. And a chain and a keep are nothing compared to a woman's kiss."
"There's more," the man said as he broke off. "Oh, a good deal more. The refrain is especially nice, I think. For hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm."
"Enough." Tyrion slid his fingers from his cloak empty. "That's not a song I would care to hear again. Ever."
"No?"
Simon Silvertongue put his harp aside and took a sip of wine.
A pity. Still, each man has his song, as my old master used to say when he was teaching me to play. Others might like my tune better. The Queen, perhaps, or your Lord Father."
Tyrion rubbed the scar over his nose and said,
"My father has no time for singers, and my sister is not as generous as one might think. A wise man could earn more from silence than from song."
He could not put it much plainer than that. Simon seemed to take his meaning quick enough.
"You will find my price modest, my lord."
"That's good to know."
This would not be a matter of 30 golden dragons, Tyrion feared.
"Tell me, at King Joffrey's wedding feast," the man said, "there is to be a tournament of singers.
and jugglers and jesters and dancing bears.
"Only one dancing bear, my lord,"
said Simon, who had plainly attended Cersei's arrangements with far more interest than Tyrion had.
"But seven singers, Galleon of Kai, Bethany Fairfingers, Aemon Costain, Alric of Ison, Hamish the Harper, Collio Canis, and Orland of Old Town will compete for a gilded lute with silver strings. Yet unaccountably, no invitation has been forthcoming for one who is master of them all. Let me guess, Simon Silvertongue."
Simon smiled modestly.
"I'm prepared to prove the truth of my boast before king and court. Hamish is old, and oft forgets what he's singing. And Collio, with that absurd Tyroshi accent. If you understand one word in three, count yourself fortunate."
"My sweet sister has arranged the feast. Even if I could secure you this invitation, it might look queer. Seven kingdoms, seven vows, seven challenges, 77 dishes, but 8 singers? What would the High Septon think?"
"You did not strike me as a pious man, my lord."
"Piety is not the point. Certain forms must be observed." Simon took a sip of wine.
"Still, a singer's life is not without peril. We ply our trade in alehouses and wine sinks before unruly drunkards. If one of your sister's seven should suffer some mishap, I hope you might consider me to fill his place."
He smiled slyly, inordinately pleased with himself. 6 singers would be as unfortunate as 8, to be sure. I will inquire after the health of Cersei's 7. If any of them should be indisposed, my man Bronn will find you."
"Very good, my lord."
Simon might have left it at that, but flushed with triumph he added,
"I shall sing the night of King Joffrey's wedding. Should it happen that I am called to court, why, I will want to offer the king my very best compositions, songs I have sung 1,000 times that are certain to please. If I should find myself singing in some dreary wine sink, though, well, that would be an apt occasion to try my new song. For the hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm."
"That will not be necessary," said Tyrion. "You have my word as a Lannister. Bronn will call upon you soon."
"Very good, my lord."
The balding, kettle-bellied singer took up his wood harp again. Bronn was waiting with the horses at the mouth of the alley. He helped Tyrion into his saddle.
"When do I take the man to Duskendale?"
"You don't," Tyrion turned his horse. "Give him 3 days, then inform him that Hamish the Harper has broken his arm. Tell him that his clothes will never serve for court, so he must be fitted for new garb at once. He'll come with you quick enough." He grimaced. "You may want his tongue. I understand it's made of silver. The rest of him should never be found." Bronn grinned.
"There's a pot shop I know in Flea Bottom makes a savoury bowl of brown. All kinds of meat in it, I hear."
"Make certain I never eat there." Tyrion spurred to a trot. He wanted a bath, and the hotter the better. Even that modest pleasure was denied him, however. No sooner had he returned to his chambers than Podrick Payne informed him that he had been summoned to the Tower of the Hand.
"His lordship wants to see you, the Hand, Lord Tywin."
"I recall who the Hand is, Pod," Tyrion said. "I lost my nose, not my wits." Bronn laughed.
"Don't bite the boy's head off now."
"Why not? He never uses it." Tyrion wondered what he'd done now.
"Or more like, what I have failed to do."
A summons from Lord Tywin always had teeth. His father never sent for him just to share a meal or a cup of wine, that was for certain. As he entered his lord father Solar, a few moments later, he heard a voice saying, "Cherry wood for the scabbards, bound in red leather and ornamented with a row of lion's head studs in pure gold.
perhaps with garnets for the eyes.
Rubies, Lord Tywin said. Garnets lack the fire.
Tyrion cleared his throat. My lord, you sent for me? His father glanced up.
I did. Come, have a look at this.
A bundle of oilcloth lay on the table between them, and Lord Tywin had a longsword in his hand.
A wedding gift for Joffrey, he told Tyrion.
The light shimmering through the diamond-shaped panes of glass made the blade shimmer black and red as Lord Tywin turned it to inspect the edge while the pommel and crossguard flamed gold.
With this fool's jabber of Stannis in his magic sword, it seemed to me that we had best give Joffrey something extraordinary as well. A king should bear a kingly weapon.
That's much too much sword for Joff, Tyrion said.
He will grow into it. Here, feel the weight of it.
He offered the weapon hilt first. The sword was much lighter than he had expected. As he turned it in his hand, he saw why. Only one metal could be beaten so thin and still have strength enough to fight with, and there was no mistaking those ripples, the mark of steel that has been folded back on itself many thousands of times.
Valyrian steel?
Yes, Lord Tywin said, in a tone of deep satisfaction.
At long last, father.
Valyrian steel blades were scarce and costly, yet thousands remained in the world, perhaps 200 in the Seven Kingdoms alone. It had always irked his father that none belonged to House Lannister. The old kings of the Rock had owned such a weapon, but the great sword Brightroar had been lost when the second king Tommen carried it back to Valyria on his fool's quest. He had never returned, nor had Uncle Gerry, the youngest and most reckless of his father's brothers, who had gone seeking after the lost sword some 8 years past. Thrice at least Lord Tywin had offered to buy Valyrian longswords from impoverished lesser houses, but his advances had always been firmly rebuffed. The little lordlings would gladly part with their daughters, should a Lannister come asking, but they cherished their old family swords. Tyrion wondered where the metal for this one had come from. A few master armourers could rework old Valyrian steel, but the secrets of its making had been lost when the doom came to old Valyria.
"The colours are strange," he commented as he turned the blade in the sunlight.
Most Valyrian steel was a grey so dark it looked almost black, as was true here as well. But blended into the folds was a red as deep as the grey. The two colours lapped over one another without ever touching, each ripple distinct, like waves of night and blood upon some steely shore.
"How did you get this patterning? I've never seen anything like it."
"Nor I, my lord," said the armourer. "I confess these colours were not what I intended, and I do not know that I could duplicate them. Your lord father had asked for the crimson of your house, and it was that colour I set out to infuse into the metal. But Valyrian steel is stubborn, eh? These old swords remember, it is said, and they do not change easily. I worked 50 spells and brightened the red time and time again, but always the colour would darken as if the blade was drinking the sun from it. And some foals would not take the red at all, as you can see. If my lords of Lannister are displeased, I will, of course, try again, as many times as you should require, but—"
"No need," Lord Tywin said. "This will serve."
"A crimson sword might flash prettily in the sun, but if truth be told, I like these colours better," said Tyrion. "They have an ominous beauty, and they make this blade unique. There is no other sword like it in all the world, I should think."
"There is one."
The armourer bent over the table and unfolded the bundle of oilcloth to reveal a second longsword. Tyrion put down Joffrey's sword and took up the other. If not twins, the two were at least close cousins. This one was thicker and heavier, a half inch wider and 3 inches longer, but they shared the same fine clean lines and the same distinctive colour, the ripples of blood and night. Three fullers, deeply incised, ran down the second blade